I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Austin and Jim. Thought we'd talk a little bit today about the close of World War II, since it happened 70 years ago this month. The complete close of it, I guess. We dropped the bomb on Japan. What are the lasting effects of that, Jim?
Well, on the positive side, there hasn't been another bomb used in anger ever since then. And indeed, the impact of the two bombs that dropped on Japan and the research it triggered into the effects of radioactivity on people, which at the time, we didn't know this. I mean, the public didn't know it, but we knew practically nothing about what the long-term effects would be. And now we know. Although, ironically, you know, if you look at this, you know, just as a numbers guy, the survivors, on average, live longer than people who didn't, you know, undergo that trauma. So I don't know if anybody's looking into that particular situation. People who did survive got better medical care, so that may be it. I haven't really looked into that, but that was one curious outcome. On the bad side, of course, you know, atomic power, you know, nuclear energy has been demonized. It's become the penultimate, you know, evil scientist, you know, concoction that nothing good can come from. Although, again, a numbers guy could tell you, well, hey, it's the safest, by any measure, it's the safest form of energy. You know, just look at the numbers. And, of course, people don't want to be bothered with numbers. I mean, those who are not bothered by numbers blow right past that. And it started a period of unprecedented peace between the major powers, including the major powers, especially Russia and the rest of the world, who had nuclear weapons. We've since found out after World War, the Cold War ended, and as I like to put World War II really ended, that the Russians were much more nervous about that than we were. In fact, a German firm was telling me there was a TV show in Germany recently about the 80s, about espionage and what have you, and the whole point apparently of the plot was East German spies sent to West Germany to find out what we were really up to with the Pershing missiles and all that stuff. I remember that vividly because I was doing a lot of it color commentary as it were on CBS at the time. I later found out after doing that, when I was down in War College, that there was a lot of, how should I put it, off-the-radar discussions and debates within the Pentagon and the highest reaches of our government about exactly, you know, what we could do with Pershing missiles and what have you. That's a whole other story. Be that as it may, another nuclear war did not break out, despite coming close in Cuba. And, of course, in the 1980s, apparently there were several incidents where the Russians almost pushed the button because they were just paranoid as hell. And we're still getting out details about that. The other outcome of the official end of World War II was the war didn't end. One of the major enemies, Russia, Soviet Russia, the Soviet Union, was still out there and was still in a state of war. They were fully mobilized, and they were threatening us, you know, for the next 4 decades because basically they were still at war with the world. And when the Russian people finally realized that, hey, you know, we're not at war with the world, they don't give a shit, the Soviet Union collapsed like a house of cards. And, of course, now we have the current problem, which, again, is an outgrowth from this, that some of the survivors, as it were, of the Soviet Union, who are now running democratic Russia, Putin and the rest of his KGB buddies, are trying to put the empire back together again and are using the same totalitarian tactics that got World War II started, you know, in the first place. So irony piled upon irony. I don't know if that's a lesson, but it sure as hell is curious.
Yeah. Austin?
Yeah, I just... add a couple of thoughts. There's a strange kind of sobriety. It's sometimes been called a type of strategic caution. I came up with, and this is intentionally playing a metaphor to its end, but it's like a nuclear firebreak on hot-headedness. I used that in a speech I gave maybe 20 years ago. You know, you think nukes are the ultimate fire, but they are. That's sort of a firebreak on hot-headedness of a certain type when the big boys collide, and you know the big boys, the United States and Russia as the Soviet Union and China, they have too much to lose, and you've also got systems there, even in dictatorships of being able to rein in. It's one guy may be the most powerful, but he doesn't have all the decision of going to war with the United States. And there's there are issues of using nuclear weapons. Even though Jim's talking about overrunning territory and the like, and some of Putin's behavior, Putin has shaken the nuclear saber, threatened Eastern Europe with it. Ha ha! We've got nukes and you don't. And again, that part of that though is to test U.S. response and see if we're going to promise the nuclear umbrella to Eastern European NATO members, as we did to the rest of NATO during the Cold War. So you can say that's Putin playing chess, and it probably is. But this nuclear firebreak on hot-headedness, what it did was move. There's always wars going on in the periphery, but they certainly became more important in the strategic sense. The Soviet Union was probing wherever it could probe, and sometimes all the probe needed was money and weapons, and then just let the local nuts do what they were going to do, even though the KGB wanted to have a little more influence than that. Sometimes that's all they wanted, because they were playing the game of agitation and disruption of the West. But then there were serious conflicts as well. And you've seen that from the Cold War, those Cold War type wars of the periphery. Post-Cold War, we've had several. And in the background of two of the biggest ones, I say the war on terror really is one war, because what you've got there are Islamist terrorists, radical Islamist terrorists. Their ultimate threat is to be able to get a hold of weapons of mass destruction. Kim, they probably already have a hold of in some small quantities, but a nuclear weapon, and would give them a tremendous destructive power. And so there's some of the raison d'etre right there, Dan, for going into Afghanistan, toppling Saddam in Iraq. Behind Saddam had nuclear weapons programs. Heck, the Israelis took out the Aserak reactor to stop it in the, what was it, early 80s, 1982, Jim, I think.
Yeah,
somewhere,
early 80s, yeah.
Somewhere in there. Remember, folks, Jim and I do this largely off the top of our heads, but that's roughly the time they did it. So the nuclear genie, as I said, escaping from the bottle, is behind some of these other conflicts as well, Dan, that are seen as, you know, on the wars on the periphery and not the big time confrontation between the major regional powers and the United States. Jim's comment too about the utility and comparative cleanliness of nuclear power is dead on, and the fact that it was anathematized, or has been anathematized, and still is in many sectors, is tragic. What it's done, at least in the United States, is stymie new generations of nuclear technology that are relatively pollution free, and you have less of a term, retirement problem, I think there's another term that's used for it. Is once you have to take it offline after its the life of a reactor is useful life is over, that's you've got less of a radioactivity problem. But the the opposition is really embedded. And there was a column I wrote, I want to say 6, 7, 8 years ago. I mean, it's up on in the On Point archive, but I was reflecting on this, and I used two instances that I remember very well out of many of, you know, one-on-one confrontations with the nuclear opponent conflating nuclear energy with nuclear weapons. And of course, if you were for nuclear energy, you know, fission, heavens, we could get fusion, fabulous, but you're a warmonger and destructive. The reason I bring it up is because I treated it with a mild sense of humor, and it was one of those columns that I continue to get email about 2 years after it ran for the same thing, but a lot of people have had that experience. So I'll move back to the end of World War II. But that's the thing is that the end of World War II is very much tied to the issue of nuclear weapons. So,
Jim, what has been the lasting effect on whether on how we develop weapons after World War II? Because World War II saw the not necessarily the introduction of a lot of new weapons, but the making them better and getting them to the point that they were deadlier and like that.
Well, it was a good news, bad news situation. For one thing, people forget that for all the technological progress during World War I and World War II in terms of, you know, weapons, this was simply technology advances that were already ongoing. You know, there was nothing radically new created, but there were new military applications created out of existing technology. Thus, as I pointed out in several of my books, as well as on a strategy page, that in World War II, all of the modern weapons, including smart bombs and electronic warfare in many forms, was first used. It was primitive, but it was workable enough to implement. And the good news is that after World War II, a lot of this weapons development had money poured into it, well, at least in the United States, but there wasn't a lot of progress. There's nothing like an ongoing war to focus your attention. And we saw this in action, for example, during Vietnam, when the helicopter gunship was miraculously invented out of nowhere. You know, that was something that nobody was even thinking of until Vietnam came along, and bingo, all of a sudden the AH-1 Cobra was there, and it was just the development of UH-1, the first military gas turbine, you know, jet engine type, you know, helicopter, first modern helicopter, if you will. That was developed in the 1950s, but nobody really saw its possibilities until there was an actual war, where people were shooting at the choppers, and they realized, well, yes, they're vulnerable, but not that vulnerable, and they're extremely useful. After World War II, unless there was a war going on, there was not a lot of real progress. Things went along slowly. Again, other examples of that was in the 1990 in the Gulf War, GPS was just starting to come online. Now, that had been an idea that had been around since the 60s. You know, the Russians were doing serious research into it in the 70s. But again, technology had to catch up. You know, the miniaturization, the instruments, as it were, had to become cheap enough and compact enough and precise enough, you know, for it to work as, you know, the visionary saw it, you know, eventually working. But that all came together in the late 80s, early 90s. And so we went into the Gulf War. And somebody at the Pentagon and outside the Pentagon pointed out to the military, says, you know, this thing is working in your part of the world. There are parts of the world where it isn't working, but enough of those satellites are up there where the Middle East is covered. And we got those stories, some of which we reported on, or I reported on the air on NBC at that point, that one of the most popular and useful gadgets was GPS devices, which parents were buying out of their own money. They would cost a couple thousand bucks a piece, you know, a thing that's built into your smartphone now for pennies. That was pretty expensive. But the troops were home and said, you know, Dad, you know, send GPS. Never mind money and lawyers. That won't help me with Saddam, but a GPS will. And that really radically changed things. And, of course, the Air Force already had this this ridiculous weapon, the GPS-guided bomb, which a lot of people in the defense industry were down on because it was so much cheaper than existing smart bombs, you know, the laser-guided, you know, the Paveway bombs, which were developed during the Vietnam War. Again, see where that's happening. My father worked on radio-controlled smart bombs during the last 2 years of World War II, kept them out of combat, but I was already, you know, here. But anyway, my brothers can be grateful for that. It basically slogged along until the 60s when, boom, it got another burst. And then it slogged along with GPS coming into use, mainly as a civilian, a commercial type, you know, product with military uses. And it radically changed warfare. Then, of course, we got another burst of innovation after 2001. You know, with the war on terror, and that's still basically ongoing. There are still radical new developments. But in terms of adding a lot to technology, that is overblown. That's defense industry propaganda. You know, and NASA is guilty of that too, saying, hey, without the space race, we wouldn't have this, this, and that. Well, they overlooked certain key facts, which I won't go into, because it just starts a religious-style debate. And I don't want to get the kind of hate mail that Austin gets. But anyway, probably coming my way anyway. But anyway, the point is that the technology was there, and countries were equipped to rapidly mobilize technology as they had learned in the 19th century to mobilize personnel and money. Because we didn't get the first modern mass armies until the 19th century, Industrial Revolution and all that. And then as technology kept, you know, going by leaps and bounds, you know, we take this for granted because a lot of these major advances happened within single lifetimes. My grandparents, for example, when they were born around, you know, 1890s, turn of the century, and they had grandparents of their own who grew up without electricity. That was in their living memory. And so electricity was still considered rather wondrous. And then, of course, when they're starting their families, radio comes on. Isn't this amazing? Real-time communication. You know, and we got these, if you study the early history of radio, it was amazing. It was like the internet is today. People were talking about people listening to real-time news. You know, and you know, in the other thousands of miles away. I mean, I think the classic case was in Texas, where some little girl fell down a well shaft, and she was, you know, she was hurt, but when she was alive, and the radio stations were there, and they'd already set up these NBC and what have you had started out as continental radio networks, and they were broadcasting live updates of the effort to save, ultimately successfully, this little girl, and that's just. And of course the suits and the NBC, you know, what have you, Paley and company, they realized, oh my God, you hear that? Yes, catching. Because the possibilities, they'd already worked out the advertising model. They said, my God, we're going to be rich. And of course, you know, Paley went out and stole the idea of some guy in Utah invented called television, and beat him in court. And I don't know, was he a Mormon?
Yes.
Okay. All right. All right. So
yeah, he actually
throw that in there
grew,
as well.
I thought we were avoiding religion, Jim. All right.
Well, it's hard to these days. But anyway, this changed everything. And then, of course, out of nowhere, as far as the older suits were concerned, came the internet. And of course, we're going through this whole thing again. So we tend to take it for granted that things are going to change in our own lifetimes. When I was a kid, radio was TV was new. I must have been 8 or 9 years old before we had our own TV, you know. I remember sneaking around to neighbors and looking in the window at their television. Of course, now, you know, forget it. You know, it's way beyond that, and it's still going. So the Cold War ended because of technology. It stayed ended because of technology. And ironically enough, you know, Comrade Putin is trying to bring it back using technology. Now, he's not going to succeed, and we don't know exactly what's going on in his mind. In fact, I've spoken to Russians. Of course, the ones I speak to are as I call, bicultural. And, you know, some of them, actually, if you want to see what Russians really think, get an insight to what Russians really think. Get onto our message boards, because we have some captive trolls. I call them captive because we know they're part of what we call the 50-ruble army. They're the paid, you know, shills on the internet for the Russian government. There are some Chinese ones there, et cetera. It's amazing that their logic. Now, part of it is from a script. You know, I mean, they're told, you know, what to push and what have you, the party line. Of course, this is straight out of the Cold War playbook. This is something the Soviets invented, you know, in the 1920s. At the same time, Sigmund Freud's nephew invented modern public relations. You know, so it's a strange, you know, world we are in. All these things colliding, politics, communications, and what have you. But nowadays, we have it in our own message boards. We have these guys who basically give you an insight into what Russians think. I mean, they make these seemingly, if you just, you know, if you're half in the bag, you know, don't read our message boards while stoned. And you say, well, there's a curious logic to what he's saying. But then one of our sober-minded, you know, commentators comes on and blows this guy apart, and they just change the subject. So God knows how subversive we are considered inside of Russia. But you see it being played out. And, of course, that's another advantage of the Internet. You know, for years, I heard this many times in the 70s and 80s down in Washington, the State Department battle about what to do with the Arabs and what it all meant. Well, now we know what it all meant. The Arabs, well, they were our allies in the 70s and 80s and what have you. We were, you know, tolerating the OPEC and the jacking the prices up and what have you, and just going along because they were our friends against the Soviets. They were building modern Islamic terrorism. We know now, and of course, you don't have to take somebody's word for it, because you can get on the internet, and you can get the English language versions, if you don't speak Arabic, and you can look at what the message they put out, and then of course, I don't know if the translation works with Arabic. I think it does, but not as well as with other languages. But if you have Arabic speaking friends like I do, or know somebody in the CIA who speaks fluent Arabic, they'll site translate these things, and it's even more outrageous than the English language. I mean, they're spewing all this hate, you know, for non-Muslims, basically. It's nothing more complicated than that. And then within the Islamic world, you have this "I'm more Islamic than now," which is why you have got Al-Qaeda, you know, which started in Saudi Arabia by Saudi Arabians, and they were eventually, you know, put down because they wanted to overthrow the Saudi Arabian government and install a more Islamic one, namely them. And then, of course, now they're being pushed aside by ISIL, which considers, you know, Al-Qaeda a bunch of panty wastes, not Islamic enough. And see, we're going to behead people on video and show you our bona fides. We're going to enslave non-Muslim women and what have you, have slave auctions, something that's actually been going on in the Arab world, you know, ever since the rest of the world outlawed slavery, but that's another story. But again, with the internet, you can go in and find witnesses. You can find more evidence of this sort of stuff. Now, unfortunately, another aspect of the internet allows people to climb into a comfortable silo and never leave. In other words, they can just talk to people that agree with them. But for the adventurous, and I noticed this years ago with Strategy Page, now a lot of leftists, for example, consider us a bunch of, you know, retrograde conservatives, but at the same time, when I look at the metrics and what have you, we get a lot of visitors from, you know, hard left sites, you know, COS and what have you. And I've had people tell me, you know, offline, as it were, where there's no, you know, sort of being overheard, that, yes, we are considered, you know, the most neutral of, you know, neutral military sites out there, even if we say things that, you know, the party line, you know, doesn't agree with. But that's the strange world we live in today. A lot of progress, but a lot of, you know, turning around and putting our heads in the sand.
Right.
Yeah, let me just pick on it. That's a fascinating analysis coming out on the technology. Jim just not only took it from World War II, but through the evolutions. I said evolution, Jim, not revolution. Okay, that's the revolution of military technology, which is everybody's always looking for that, but the evolutions during the Cold War. Let me just point out some systems that were developed in World War II. Nothing is developed whole cloth. Everything is, you know, the, like Newton said, he stands on the shoulders of the giants of the past, and all technology has prior roots. But to a large degree, the nuclear weapons program that the United States had, the Manhattan Project, was something that was just a giant leap on its own. From the Einstein writing a letter to FDR after being coaxed by several of his colleagues that, yes, this could work, and giving FDR a punch to put it in, and other senior American leaders a punch to push the program. Certainly, and that's, but there were some other ones, and Jim was mentioning a relative working in a advanced technology in World War II. Jim knows this fellow. He's since deceased, but he's a grand uncle of mine who worked for Bell Labs, and his project for 2 years was one that just had a top priority. At least they were told that, even though they'd occasionally run into things where, no, you can't have it, which would puzzle them, and it was acoustic torpedoes. And as he said, we had to invent really new metallurgies, new technologies, and the like. Okay. But the thing is, there's a push, and there are a lot of things that come out of that aren't just naval weapons. They learned a great deal about picking up sounds at a great distance and sound differentiation, because here they're doing with all these old analog systems, and I'm going to try to keep this as tight as possible because my uncle would go on forever about it, but to be able to tease out of the sounds of the ocean the screws and the signals of a Nazi U-boat. And it was just, there are a lot of things that plays out in so many ways in the contemporary world. One other thing, though, let's move from technology. It, after World War II, second chance, attempt to graft the what's called the Westphalian nation state system on the rest of the world. And I said graft because the anti-Westphalians, like ISIL, say it's being imposed, and that's the United Nations. You know, hear the term tribes with flags? No, they're not really nation states, but they got a seat in the UN and they have a flag, and they look like a nation state. And the idea behind that was, is if you could formalize governments in many of these unruled and chaotic places, or, you know, that maybe there'd be more peace, or there'd be guidance provided by the Security Council and the like. And also the Security Council would serve as a chamber to decompress passions and add more sobriety when a conflict arose. Argue about its success rate. Better that it exists than not. I'm sure that'll lead to email, but you've got, that was something that came out of World War II. And it, you know, we saw the League of Nations didn't work, but this is going to be more muscular. And of course, the big complaint about the UN is that it's lethargic, not muscular enough, crooked, and a waste of effort. At the same time, there's some UN programs that if they didn't exist, you'd want to invent them. But that's the way it's built and brought about in 1945 and 46 is a World War II product. And does it apply in the 21st century? Why isn't Germany on the Security Council permanent member? Why isn't India? The Indians wonder about that when they look at the Chinese. I think they have legitimate cases. The Japanese used to suggest some things, but then they've kind of backed off on it. But it's not quote unquote reflective of quote unquote current reality. Germany says they don't say this in the open, and it's very tempered because they don't want to tick the French off. But Germany's the most important country in Europe. The other one that argue with it really is the United Kingdom. Certainly the most powerful economically, and how come it's not a permanent member of the Security Council? And then that's the European version. I've already stated it about India, but that's something coming out of the end of World War II. One other thing too. Jim's talking about where we are now. This week's column, even though I talked about the end of World War II tied to its origins, failure to fight fanatics, that's tough. And we're sort of parrying with them, and we've been fighting them since 2001. But if you use the term fanatics and correctly apply it to Nazis or Japanese militarist imperialists, I mean, what the war faction, as it roots of the war faction, you see in the early 1930s, they're the ones that engineer the war in China, and that effectively begins in 1931. They weren't confronted. Man, League of Nations doesn't do anything to Mussolini when his forces invade Ethiopia. And Ethiopia had more of a governmental structure, haven't it been in existence in some shape, form, or fashion for well over 2,000 years, but an empire, really. But it had a nation-state structure, and the League of Nations fails to respond. And I went through some of those failures to confront them. If you don't confront the fanatics, that empowers them. And that comes back to the discussion of appeasement. And whether you think you're appeasing them or not, they interpret it that way. And so that says something about a permanent feature of a certain type of human psychology. But it's also extremely dangerous if you, I'm saying, you do not drop your guard with these guys, and sometimes you have to take it to them. And we didn't do it in the 1930s, or it was haphazard and not focused. And then suddenly September 1939 rolls around, even though the Chinese say, "Why do you say that, Mr. Bay?" I think I've gotten one letter, only one, so I'm not going to exaggerate on this. You can go look at stuff that we have up on Strategy Page. We realize what the Japanese were doing in China, the depredations there. We've also written about the Golkin Gaul, the fight between the Russians and the Japanese, where Zhukov defeated the Japanese offensive really into Siberia, and then that was neutralized. The Russians stood up to Japanese fanaticism and cooled them for really until the last month of the war, when the Russians decided to grab what they wanted to grab. So I'll turn it back over to Jim.
Well, I think we're actually at the end of our time here. It's interesting to see what's happened over the last 70 years, and how I think Jim's really right that, you know, the war continued until 1991, and in some sense we re-entered the 1930s,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
Or the 1920s after 1991, and so we're actually have looped completely back to there, and now we're facing those exact same things.
Well, they're not exactly the same, but they're scary echoes, which is the point of when
right.
I talk about the failure to confront the fanaticism. Instead of going into that, let folks go read the column, and you'll see what the historical argument for it. I'm just staying the gist of it. No, yeah, I'm. Jim's right.
Yeah,
it's scary. It's a scary series of echoes, Dan.
Yeah, and I exaggerated there with the exact same
name. Yeah. Well, that's okay.
Same situation.
Sure.
But anyhow, we'll wrap it up there, and we'll talk to you guys next time.
Bye, guys.